You mentioned, just going back to something you mentioned earlier, you mentioned the sort of the idea of the exporting of, Australian logging policy, of forestry policy and so on to the Pacific. To what extent would you say that the Papua New Guinea regulatory environment, the sort of the laws and so on that are in place, conform to the classic sort of neoliberal let big business do everything, or is it more nuanced than that in Papua New Guinea?
I think there's a lot of influence from outside with outside models. The original forestry legislation, which was enacted back in 1963, was an Australian model. And it was essentially a model brought in from Queensland. For example, it imposed what was called a 30-year rotation cycle. Now, why 30 years? Well, that's what they did in Queensland. So there was that type of stupidity to it. The World Bank then came in the 1990s and sort of modernized that. But what the World Bank was concerned with was, one, competitive tendering. So it brought in the idea that if forest concessions were going to be let out, there would be competitive tendering. And it was also concerned about what it called sustainable development, because the sustainable development was a buzzword at that particular point in time, still is. And the idea was that there would be sustainable forest management, which in a mixed species tropical forest is highly idealistic, because it's very, very difficult to replicate the forest once you've taken out the major key species, which is what logging does. So there was an attempt, but it was highly idealistic. So first off, the forest regulations was in essence lifted from Queensland and plopped down in Papua New Guinea, and then you get the World Bank coming along with its what I would call rather mushy concepts of sustainable development, and they don't really fit neither. What does fit in Papua New Guinea would be small forest operations run by Papua New Guineans and medium-sized forest operations that were integrated into producing things like furniture and housing materials on a local scale. But of course, the government doesn't want that, because it can't get the taxes from exports, and the World Bank doesn't want that, and the IMF doesn't want that, because it doesn't fit into the globalization policies. They all want big. They all want industrial scale. Now, big and industrial scale actually deconstruct Papua New Guinea's small societies. So that's where the tension is.
You've mentioned the role of non-governmental organisations in some of the different struggles and so on in Papua New Guinea around the environment, around social justice, but I guess there's another side to that, which I know that some people in Papua New Guinea have been very critical of the role of, for example, organisations that claim to be non-governmental organisations, I guess on paper are non-governmental organisations, like Conservation International. Do you want to talk a bit about the role of Conservation International in Papua New Guinea and why there are concerns about them?
Well, I mean, I think that largely these big international non-government organizations, and in Papua New Guinea we call those BINGOs, big international non-government organizations. The BINGOs tend to suffer from two things. One is their ties to big corporations, and that's generally through funding or through interlocking directorships. So either a BINGO will have big injections of capital from oil companies and IT companies and things like that, or they have interlocking directorships, that people who sit on oil company boards and on IT company boards also sit on the BINGO boards too. And that's the first thing. The second thing is that the BINGOs tend to chase after the big money that comes from the corporations and through the foundations that are set up with corporation money, and they also chase after government money. Well, because governments are locked in with corporations, I mean, that's a little enclosed circle on its own. The second major critique of them, I think, can best be spelt out in sort of medical terms. I mean, they are incredibly bad managers, and the major symptom of their bad management would be like an attention deficit hyperactive disorder, that they keep forgetting what they're doing half the time. They can't focus, and yet they run around doing things without talking to the Papua New Guinean NGOs. So there's a lot of anger currently in Papua New Guinea about the activities of corporations such as WWF, Conservation International in particular, because those organizations have intercepted the funding, really. And this is almost like a cargo cult analogy, that the Papua New Guinean non-government organizations are the ones who are actually carrying out the fight at the coalface, so to speak, in defense of the environment. And they have a hard struggle maintaining themselves, accessing funds. When along come these big international non-government organizations, well-funded, and they start to cooperate with the government that the Papua New Guinea NGOs are actually struggling with. I mean, the government in Papua New Guinea is locked in with the logging companies, with the Malaysian logging companies, and the mining companies too. And so the big international NGOs take the position of, oh, we have to be conciliatory, we have to work in cooperation with government. Well, if you're conciliatory and you work in cooperation with corrupt governments, what are you?
Right. So I guess there's a real sense of frustration in terms of like looking at how all of these different players interlock. You have the World Bank, you have the IMF, you have the Australian government, you have the corporations, and then to cap it all off, you also have non-governmental organisations that are all kind of part of a. Or at least share a lot of the similar kinds of interests, not to mention the Papua New Guinea government too.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Brian, just to wrap up, I'm wondering, we're talking to you from Montreal, Canada, and as we started off talking about it, Papua New Guinea is a country that's sort of on the periphery of the periphery. What can people do in countries like Canada to support struggles on the ground of Papua New Guinean people in defence of their environment, in defence of their rights?
Well, I mean, I think maintain pressure on corporations and on your own elected representatives. Just don't believe that you don't count, and don't believe that people don't listen to your complaints. So, Canada, for example, you've got Placer sitting there. Placer's one of the big rapers of Papua New Guinea. It pollutes our rivers. It pollutes our seas. We've just had a monumental cyanide spill from Placer. Placer is a company which spends an awful lot of money on its spin doctors, essentially lying and telling people how good it is, when in fact it's a monumental polluter in Papua New Guinea. So anything that we can do to put pressure on Placer, either directly on the corporation itself or through the elected Canadian representatives, would be very helpful.
Okay, Brian, thanks very much for joining us today. We've been listening to Brian Brunton, who's an environmental lawyer and a long-time campaigner in Papua New Guinea for environmental and social justice. Very privileged to have him on the Monday morning after show.